Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Wyatt. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. President Joe Biden on Friday became the first president in our short history to actually acknowledge that it is Indigenous Peoples Day. He released a presidential proclamation, and it is the most significant boost yet to efforts to refocus the federal holiday celebrating Columbus, take it off of Columbus, and put it back on who we should be lifting up and celebrating. We have a couple of black holidays in this country, and really, there's a lot of tension around at least one of them. We have a day celebrating the work, the life, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. When you think about the work that the advocates are doing who stand against critical race theory, they've lumped the teaching of Dr. King in with critical race theory. Though I do see a direct connection, it's just odd that they want some teachers not to teach about Martin Luther King Jr., and yet we have a holiday named after him. We really credit his wife, Coretta Scott King, with that work, the work that she did to make sure that Martin's name would not be forgotten in this country. I mean, she reworked his legacy, because when Dr. King was murdered in this country, he was not as beloved as he is now. In fact, he was not seen or esteemed very highly. But they reworked his legacy. The second, of course, is Juneteenth Day, which has a lot of problems. Juneteenth Day is really complicated. And let me tell you what I mean by this. Is that I get the celebration that we're having around the freedom movement for enslaved people. I get that. I think my real problem with Juneteenth, which began over in Texarkana, is this notion is that is when the people who were in the farmost portions of the Confederate States of America, that's when those enslaved people found out, after everyone else knew, that we were free. We had been legally freed by the 13th Amendment. I think that as we're talking about Indigenous Peoples Day, it's time for us to really pull this out. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to share a conversation that I had with you, with people from the Indigenous and Black communities talking about Indigenous Peoples Day and the complications around it. Stay with us. Welcome to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, here again to have another conversation about some of the stories that matter. Today we have a special that's working with the Carson Institute for a colloquium series called The Lies Our Teachers Told Us. From Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, telling the truth about America's history. We want to explore the lies about Columbus Day. We want to explore the truths about Indigenous Peoples Day and why it's not a national holiday. And what does this mean about our country? I'm joined now by three guests to help us explore this in detail. Dr. Delia Gillis, Professor of History and Founding Director for the Center for Africana Studies, University of Central Missouri. Dr. Gillis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Luhiwi White Bear is Assistant Professor for the School of Language, Culture, and Society and serves as a Center Director for the Kukuiest Mana Inhas. Dr. White Bear, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So happy to have you join us. And Dr. Catherine Dungy, Associate Professor for Caribbean and Latin American History, St. Michael's College. Dr. Dungy, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to start with Dr. White Bear. I think it's interesting as we talk about Columbus Day, that there was a teaching in America that some of us may remember when we were children, that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And we were taught for a very long time the lie that Columbus discovered America. Can you talk a little bit about the dangers of this lie and what this means coming from different communities?
Great. Yes, that is definitely one of the top things that I often hear in my intro to Native studies is like, I feel deceived. And I think that's one of the dangers, is that when people move on from their K-12 experience into other realms and learn more, they feel like they've been lied to and feel deceived by their education. And I think that kind of destabilizes some of the other things that they may have learned as well. I know for myself, when I was in elementary school, I would get kicked out for saying Columbus was a rapist and murderer in class during those lessons as an elementary child. And which I probably should not, like, in retrospect, like, thinking about free speech laws, should not have been kicked out of school, because first of all, it was true. And second of all, you should be able to have healthy dialogue and discussions in classrooms. And so I think that it prevents those kind of opportunities from happening. And it's happened even more in recent times, where there's been a lot of folk that try to bring things up in the classroom, but it's kind of pushed aside, or, well, he was also great. And I think we run into this parallel story going on in narrative that's really, really whitewashed and really dismissive of the genocide, the sexual violence, and the slavery that happened as a result of his direct orders. That's well documented.
Dr. Gillis, can you talk a bit about the dangers of this lie? What does it do to the psyche of Black and brown and white children to learn about Christopher Columbus by, in a way, crushing down the truth about the Indigenous community?
Well, I agree with my colleague over and over again. I find that students are really hurt about the deception. At my institution, we teach a lot of teachers. We're the highest producers of teachers in our state. And they really are very upset about not being told the truth. They don't understand why we don't tell them the truth or the whole story. But particularly for our Black and brown students, it just really creates that narrative. It continues the oppression of the mind and the spirit about their role in this world and the contributions that they've made, but also the oppression that they have suffered. And so we have to look at the different perspectives when we're looking at our American presidents and the roles that they have played in enslavement and oppression in these communities.
Dr. Dungy, what about the dangers involved with teaching children to revere a man who was clearly a rapist? He was a murderer. In fact, he got lost, so he wasn't even good at doing directions. Like, what does that mean to have us build a truth in this country based upon a lie?
It is one of the hardest things as an educator, or at least an educator who wants to build truth and to look at history in an inclusive and an open way, to be able to do that. Often we are challenged, and especially as a brown face in front of the classroom, speaking these truths and trying to get the real story out there. I think, you know, what both of my colleagues have said, it's that danger, that occlusion is the danger, and trying to get it to the students. Once they hear it, they're open to it, and they're receptive to it, and they want to know more. And that's the joy of it, being able to be there as their eyes are opening and they're seeing other truths.
Dr. Whitebear, how is Columbus taught in Indigenous communities?
Yeah, can I go back to the other question and ask something really quick?
Absolutely.
Yeah. As my colleagues were talking, I'm also thinking about the dangers that lie in celebrating somebody who did commit these acts, right? Teaches in the minds of everybody of who can inflict violence on whom and when it's acceptable and celebrated, and where the silences around those violences are placed, which is usually on Black and brown bodies, as being framed as more acceptable to receiving violence. And I think that it connects to that directly. And we have a national holiday of somebody who did these things that continues to be celebrated. So I think for an Indigenous communities, being able to talk about this more openly and talk about the current day implications because a lot of times people are like, that was like so long ago, it was over 500 years ago. And I'm like, well, not just me, like a lot of Native communities are like still feeling these long-term effects of what happened. And a lot of people don't even speak of the Taino people who he first encountered, right? They just think that they're gone and they're still alive. And so there's a lot of conversations about trying to reclaim this day as a, like it was constructed as a counter holiday initially, and it's been transformed into celebrating Indigenous people, our survival, our resilience, our triumphs, and our current, and bringing awareness to current day issues. And I think that's what's the framing is shifting to big time in Indigenous communities, is like, we need to learn what happened because it had these long-term impacts on our communities, and we need to be able to speak truth about them and find ways to address the issues that we face. And so teaching the truth, finding ways to systematically make changes. And if that has, if that's a national conversation about why Indigenous Peoples Day occurs at the same time, same day as Columbus Day, a lot of people don't understand, like, why don't you just do it a different day? It's like on purpose. And it's not to celebrate the conquer and the conquered together. It's to counter that story and be a counter holiday, counter narrative to everything we've been taught. And I think in a lot of Indigenous communities, of course, not every single one, because there's so many in North America and beyond, that that is the ongoing conversation, though, is we need to talk about the truth and we need to celebrate who we are.
Dr. Gila, so are we in kind of a moment of reckoning? I think about the fact that earlier this year, President Joe Biden, I mean, really, it happened immediately, that he declared that Juneteenth was a national holiday. And when you think about what that actually meant, to shut down the government and to say, we're going to put this day aside so that everyone, now whether that meant you were going to Juneteenth sales or you were buying red, black, and green candles, whatever that meant for you, it was a national recognition of the importance of Juneteenth Day, which is problematic. Should the same thing be happening for Indigenous Peoples Day? I remember that Columbus Day was a holiday. I remember not going to school on Columbus Day. And now, of course, so many things are open for Indigenous Peoples Day.
I think it is. And that's the problem. We have to understand that all of these holidays, statues, and monuments were created to undergird particular power structures. So it is a time of reckoning. To add to that conversation, I've been based out of and teaching the history of the centennial of the massacre in Tulsa and how that story has been told. So when you use the word reckoning, I think that's really important, because in that case, there's a reckoning around the destruction of a community and reparations. And so I think the same thing applies to Juneteenth, it applies to Indigenous Peoples Day, that there's this reckoning about the inclusion of all the history. There is a place to speak about Columbus, but when you provide, I don't even want to call it a counter narrative, a complete narrative of what has happened. It does bring you to a different perspective. And I think it is important that the holiday was established, but at the same time, you really don't want it to be about MLK Day and, you know, mattress sales or that the exploitation that capitalism brings to making these days a national holiday. That's also a problem with it.
Well, then, Dr. Dungy, if that is the case, right, we're celebrating not, as Dr. Whitebear said, the conqueror and the conquered at the same time. It is deliberate. Where do we then work to help clear up the confusion that children are feeling? Because children, when I just kind of did a random kind of anecdotal, you know, check, talking to children, what is today? So many of them said Columbus Day, didn't know Indigenous peoples. Like the message seems to be getting lost here.
It's part of a, I like the word reckoning, of coming to an understanding of how history is taught. It's not an incremental, we'll give them the easy story now and then we'll problematize it later. Is problematic. Mm-hmm. And we need to tell children from the beginning what those problems are. And we don't give children enough credit. They can figure things out, and they understand that things aren't just A or B. There's so much going on around it. I run into the same problem. I teach about this point, this historical juncture, and I talk about all the Indigenous peoples who are here in this part of the world. It was their world, and somebody just bumped into it. They know about the Aztec. They know about the Inca, although they often get mixed up. But then I say, well, do you know who was actually the first peoples to encounter the Spanish? And if I'm lucky, there's one person, and they're usually Puerto Rican, who says, oh, yes, it's Taino. I have a whole unit on that. And it's there, again, as you've been saying, students are mad, they're upset, they're disheartened that this was not part of the story, that that their story of the United States starts with the Pilgrims. Again, that's problematic because there's people here before that too. But this whole idea that the whole of the Americas started with this interaction between a Caribbean Indigenous group and the Spanish. And from that moment, our whole story of subjugation, of domination, of what the United States and the Americas became, it starts at that moment. And we have to really trust the students. They when they hear this, they are willing to do the work to find those answers. And a lot of my students are teacher educators, and they want to know how to do this at an early stage, so that you're not hoping somebody actually takes your class in college to find out these truths.
Well, Dr. Whitebear, I think that we have to kind of recognize that our students are not just the ones in the classroom, that we're also sending out the knowledge to their parents. I mean, that's where the resistance is. If we're really trying to get to the heart of critical race theory, it's not the students saying, I want to opt out of this teaching. That is coming from the parents and really taking us down to the root of white supremacy. Like, whose history is valued enough to be taught to everyone and taught the same way?
Yeah, I totally see what you're saying with that, especially with the younger in the K-12 arena. And by the time they get to college, classes are really confused about the histories. And I really like your approach, Dr. Dungy, about the whole unit on Tainos. That's so important. And one of the other things too that always comes up is how Columbus is like this hero for Italian Americans when he wasn't even acting on behalf of Italy. And I'm like, there's also other awesome Italian people, you know, that didn't commit all these atrocities that could be celebrated perhaps instead of using that. But it doesn't really reflect Italian American history. It reflects colonization in Spanish history. And I think that message gets lost because of his own personal identity, and it gets conflated. And that happens all the way down into the K-12 arena, where people are like, we should be able to celebrate other people's identities too, and turning it into that instead of looking at the fuller picture. But I do think that a lot of the resistance has to do with helping educate parents and community as well. One of the things I always appreciate hearing in some of my classes from students is like when they reflect in their assignments and say, I'm sharing this at home, I'm sharing this with my friends, and seeing those ripple effects, I think, are really powerful. And we just got to keep doing more of that, because right now it's not part of standard curriculum to teach about what really happened, of course, and that fuller picture. Thanks for the reminder, Dr. Gillis, about it's not really the counter narrative, it's the actual, like, a fuller picture. It's a fuller history of what happened. It's not an alternative history, it's reality of what was experienced. And all of those pieces have to fit together. I think part of why kids are confused too is because this was actually the first year that a US president has proclaimed Indigenous Peoples Day. And that just happened on Friday, right? President Biden was the first president that ever declared or proclaimed Indigenous Peoples Day at the federal level. It's never happened before. And it was also the first time I've ever seen the federal Columbus Day proclamation include the part about the atrocities and the impacts on Indigenous people. I've never seen that included in the presidential, like the federal proclamation for Columbus Day either. And so I think those two things will help as we continue to move towards change in education and ripple effects out into the communities and with families and stuff too.
And so I want to bring to the stage, we have Dr. Mia White is joining us. And Dr. White is an assistant professor of environmental studies at the New School. And she should be joining the stage. Dr. White, how are you?
Hi, I'm here. I'm so sorry about that mix up. I'm here.
No problem.
Oh,
you,
are we?
You'd be kind enough to turn your camera on. We'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. And so while Dr. White is getting set up, Dr. Gillis, I want to come back to you. Isn't American history based upon lies? I'm just thinking that if we're talking about Christopher Columbus and the lie around Christopher Columbus, but we can add George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin. Like, I mean, it's the lies around men who are not of color defending, setting up, going west as far as they can, no matter who they kill in the way. Isn't that what America seems to be based upon?
Well, yes, it's selective amnesia. So let's just say a few things about Christopher Columbus first. And there's a whole reggae song that says Christopher Columbus, goddamn liar. You know, on the island of Jamaica, the reggae artists get it correctly from the very beginning. But Christopher Columbus was also not always revered. The crown, they were shirking him like a bill collector at the end of his life. He had no prestige at the time that he passed. Christopher Columbus is resurrected in creating a narrative in modern America as a part of the Columbian Exposition. So that's how we get Columbus rewritten into the narrative. That's how you get the ties to the Italian American community in terms of this period in our history where we're creating whiteness, where you become white and what makes you white. A parallel story in South Africa. It's not until 1952 that they begin to have the Van Riebeck days to honor the explorer that supposedly founded South Africa. I mean, it's really about the first European contact. Let's go back to Ivan van Sertima's. They came before Columbus. We know that there were other explorers and other groups in the hemisphere. So I had to say that. And then just very quickly, so we can include Professor White. Yes, we have different versions of our founding leaders. And so one of the assignments that I have my students do is, you know, is George Washington our president? But he's also a slave catcher. Enslaved individuals that escape with him from him, you know, he pursues them. Ona Judge is one of those, and she's never returned, but he pursues them. Andrew Carnegie, is he a robber baron or a gospel of wealth? And so the whole point to what I'm offering here is that we need to look at the whole picture and not be selective about these leaders, but clearly the selective story that we have received undergirds a certain power position.
Thank you, Dr. Gillis. Dr. Mia White, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at the New School, thank you for joining us. I just want to pull you into the conversation about the lies that we have been taught. I'm saying this as an adult. I remember the teaching of Christopher Columbus. The lies that we're fighting that are no longer being taught in some classrooms. But it seems like our country is a country that's based upon lies and not about the truth of history.
I agree. I mean, I think it's very difficult for people to confront and grapple with the depth of lies that we've been conditioned with. And this starts when we're very young. I mean, really, unfortunately, it even starts in our families. some of our family histories gloss over certain realities and certain truths, just even in our families. And that has to do with trauma and really history, right? A history of trauma that we pass on intergenerationally. But the institution of the school as an institution has been profoundly harmful to all of our children, particularly to Indigenous children. And of course, to all children of color and to white children. So, you know, thinking in a collective liberation perspective requires that we confront these lies that my teacher told me, as you phrased it. You know, I teach several courses that are a combination of Black studies, environmental justice, and geography at the New School. And one in particular is called Environmental History, Race, and Natural Resource Management. And in this class, it's an undergraduate course. This is often the very first time that students are exposed to a course that connects space and race. Sometimes, in fact, it's the only course that they've ever had, you know, freshman, sophomore, junior, on race whatsoever. So there's a lot of deconstructing that needs to happen. And that's why we visit through some pedagogy that helps to help students build a vocabulary and a sort of a ability to talk through what they have to unlearn. Some things that students have said to me is, I thought Native Americans were extinct. Other things that students have told me is, Prof, I thought that reservations were an Indigenous practice. In other words, that there's something Indigenous about reservations, not that they were colonizing, they are a colonizing artifact of the US American state, things like this. So we have to kind of work through all of this as we're also grappling with, you know, broader structures of white supremacy, anti-Blackness, slavery, enslavement, et cetera, and so forth. So, you know, those are sort of some of the things. And I have a couple favorite resources that we talk through in the class and certain ideas that we often have to grapple with that sometimes can be very tense for students. And I'm happy to talk about that.
Dr. White, as a follow-up question for that, what is the connection between race and place? Because some people don't understand that where you are situationally, where you are physically, even where you are mentally and emotionally, does go through the lens of race and how you see valued.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking that. I mean, for my kids, for my undergraduates, you know, we talk about race as being invented through processes of racism, to speak in shorthand. And when we think geographically about race, we have to emplace it. You know, we have to think spatially. So in terms of geography, we talk about geography as multidimensional. It's your sort of coordinates, you know, where you are, you know, literally like on a map. And then it's also maybe like your address, right? So my office at the New School is 66 West 12th Street. So that would help you understand sort of my place. But then you could also say a Lenape land, unceded Lenape land. You know, alternatively, you could also say the New School. These are all imaginaries. So when we think geographically, we want to unpack how race interacts with these imaginaries and how we got there. How did we get to 66 West 12th Street being associated with the New School as an institution that is on unceded Lenape land? So it really requires the students to think, obviously, intersectionally, historically, and in an interdisciplinary way, which again, sometimes in terms of their previous schooling, can present a little bit of a challenge, but I find it really exciting. And one thing that I say to my students, usually in the first or second week of classes, for my Black geography students too, is when we're sort of unpacking the sort of structures and pillars of white supremacy, it's really important to think about the role of the state, the American state. And one way to do that, especially for Black folks, I identify as a Black woman of African American and Korean descent, I'm able to communicate to my Black students who understand about how the state invented blood quotas, right? We understand that history quite well. From the Native American side, you know, we can employ that same lens and understand how the American state employed that tool, but it in a little bit of a different way. Whereas from the Black American perspective, I should say Black, because at that time, of course, African Americans had no citizenship rights. But from the Black perspective, if you had quote unquote one drop, right, of quote unquote enslaved blood, you were Black. From the Native American perspective, you had to keep proving your full bloodedness for the purposes of your imminent erasure, right? Because the more illegitimate your claim to indigeneity was, the easier, of course, it is to make a claim about land theft and really genocide. So these are pillars that help students kind of understand the role of the state, so that this is a little bit beyond interpersonal ideas about justice and really thinking about justice in the full way we need to grapple with it.
Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, we're going to continue with our conversation with members of both the Indigenous and the Black community, talking about Indigenous Peoples Day and the lies my teacher told us about Christopher Columbus. Let's go to it now.
Dr. Whitebear, I want to come back to you because we mentioned earlier that we are kind of at a moment of reckoning. That was the word that Dr. Dungey said. You know, I like that word, reckoning. I'm saying beyond reckoning, I'm thinking reparations. Like, what would that look like for the Indigenous community? And I think in your answer, if you could also even speak about terminology, because some people say, you know, the Indigenous community, some people use Native American, like people are just trying to figure out, you know, just like within the Black community, from African American to color to Negro, what is the correct terminology to even use?
Well, that's a really long answer.
You can break it up into two parts.
Let's see. So let's talk about terminology real quick. Most Indigenous folk prefer to be referred to by their community or their tribal names. So for example, I usually identify myself as a member of the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation with Huastec and Cochimi ancestry, like naming the ancestral connections to lands and waters in that way, in recognizing where we are on other people's lands too. Sort of like Dr. White had mentioned about being on unceded Lenape lands and stuff, like knowing where we are in relation to other Indigenous folk. Like I know I'm on Kalapuya land, and when I go to other places, I look where I'm at because it helps me recognize the place in relation to my own identities, in my own stories of migration and ancestral land in contemporary times. And so I think that for Indigenous peoples, having folk be comfortable with knowing that there's 574 federally recognized tribes in the United States. That does not include all the Indigenous folk in Canada, in Mexico, in the Caribbean, the Pacific Islands, Central America, which is part of North America anyways, but there's like all these ways that Indigenous people are compartmentalized and looked at as if you're not part of the federally recognized tribes, that you don't count. So when you hear Indigenous, that's the broader term for beyond the United States usually. And that recognition that identity transcends like geopolitical settler borders, which actually split some nations in half along the Canadian and Mexican borders in particular. And so I think with terminology, Indigenous is a broader inclusive term. Native American Indian / Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, those are very political terms that are often used with demographics, government reporting. They kind of relate to the census, they relate to treaty, our treaties being honored or not honored in those governmental relationships as sovereign nations. And so not all tribes have sovereign status. So for example, my coastal Chumash tribe is, there's only one federally recognized Chumash tribe out of several, and we're not one of them. So we don't have that governmental relationship with the settler state of the United States. And so those terminologies